File 36. In those days I cared nothing for politics, but I could not help forming an opinion on certain manifestations which affected not only the whole nation, but also us soldiers in particular. There were two things which caused me the greatest anxiety at that time, and which I had come to regard as detrimental to our interests. Shortly after our first series of victories, a certain section of the press already began to throw cold water, drip by drip, on the enthusiasm of the public. At first, this was not obvious to many people. It was done under the mask of good intentions and a spirit of anxious care. The public was told that big celebrations of victories were somewhat out of place and were not worthy expressions of the spirit of a great nation. The fortitude and valour of German soldiers were accepted facts which did not necessarily call for outbursts of celebration. Furthermore, it was asked, what would foreign opinion have to say about these manifestations? Would not foreign opinion react more favourably to a quiet and sober form of celebration, rather than to all this wild jubilation? Surely the time had come, so the press declared, for us Germans to remember that this war was not our work, and that hence there need be no feeling of shame in declaring our willingness to do our share towards effecting an understanding among the nations. For this reason it would not be wise to sully the radiant deeds of our army with unbecoming jubilation, for the rest of the world would never understand this. Furthermore, nothing is more appreciated than the modesty with which a true hero quietly and unassumingly carries on and forgets. Such was the gist of their warning. Instead of catching these fellows by their long ears and dragging them to some ditch and looping a cord around their necks, so that the victorious enthusiasm of the nation should no longer offend the aesthetic sensibilities of these knights of the pen, a general press campaign was now allowed to go on against what was called unbecoming and undignified forms of victorious celebration. No one seemed to have the faintest idea that when public enthusiasm is once damped, nothing can enkindle it again when the necessity arises. This enthusiasm is an intoxication and must be kept up in that form. Without the support of this enthusiastic spirit, how would it be possible to endure in a struggle which, according to human standards, made such immense demands on the spiritual stamina of the nation? I was only too well acquainted with the psychology of the broad masses not to know that in such cases a magnanimous aestheticism cannot fan the fire which is needed to keep the iron hot. In my eyes, it was even a mistake not to have tried to raise the pitch of public enthusiasm still higher. Therefore, I could not at all understand why the contrary policy was adopted, that is to say, the policy of damping the public spirit. Another thing which irritated me was the manner in which Marxism was regarded and accepted. I thought that all this proved how little they knew about the Marxist plague. It was believed, in all seriousness, that the abolition of party distinctions during the war had made Marxism a mild and moderate thing. But here there was no question of party. There was a question of a doctrine which was being expounded for the express purpose of leading humanity to its destruction. The purpose of this doctrine was not understood, because nothing was said about that side of the question in our Jew-ridden universities, and because our supercilious bureaucratic officials did not think it worthwhile to read up a subject which had not been prescribed in the university course. This mighty revolutionary trend was going on beside them, but those intellectuals would not deign to give it their attention. That is why state enterprise nearly always lags behind private enterprise. Of these gentry, one can truly say that their maxim is, "What we don't know won't bother us." In the August of 1914, the German worker was looked upon as an adherent of Marxist socialism. That was a gross error. When those fateful hours dawned, the German worker shook off the poisonous clutches of that plague. Otherwise, he would not have been so willing and ready to fight. And people were stupid enough to imagine that Marxism had now become national. Another apt illustration of the fact that those in authority had never taken the trouble to study the real tenor of Marxist teaching. If they had done so, such foolish errors would not have been committed. Marxism, whose final objective was, and is, and will continue to be, the destruction of all non-Jewish national states, had to witness in those days of July 1914 how the German working classes, which it had been inveigling, were aroused by the national spirit and rapidly ranged themselves on the side of the fatherland. Within a few days, the deceptive smokescreen of that infamous national betrayal had vanished into thin air, and the Jewish bosses suddenly found themselves alone and deserted. It was as if not a vestige had been left of that folly and madness which the masses of the German people had been inoculated for 60 years. That was indeed an evil day for the betrayers of German labour. The moment, however, that the leaders realized the danger which threatened them, they pulled the magic cap of deceit over their ears and, without being identified, played the part of mimes in the national reawakening. The time seemed to have arrived for proceeding against the whole Jewish gang of public pests. Then it was that action should have been taken, regardless of any consequent whining or protestation. At one stroke, in the August of 1914, all the empty nonsense about international solidarity was knocked out of the heads of the German working classes. A few weeks later, instead of this stupid talk sounding in their ears, they heard the noise of American-manufactured shrapnel bursting above the heads of the marching columns as a symbol of international comradeship. Now that the German worker had rediscovered the road to nationhood, it ought to have been the duty of any government which had the care of the people in its keeping to take this opportunity of mercilessly rooting out everything that was opposed to the national spirit. While the flower of the nation's manhood was dying at the front, there was time enough at home, at least, to exterminate this vermin. But instead of doing so, His Majesty the Kaiser held out his hand to these hoary criminals, thus assuring them his protection and allowing them to regain their mental composure. And so the viper could begin his work again. This time, however, more carefully than before, but still more destructively. While honest people dreamt of reconciliation, these perjured criminals were making preparations for a revolution. Naturally, I was distressed at the half-measures which were adopted at that time, but I never thought it possible that the final consequences could have been so disastrous. But what should have been done then? Throw the ringleaders into jail, prosecute them, and rid the nation of them? Uncompromising military measures should have been adopted to root out the evil. Parties should have been abolished, and the Reichstag brought to its senses at the point of the bayonet, if necessary. It would have been still better if the Reichstag had been dissolved immediately. Just as the Republic today dissolves the parties when it wants to, so in those days there was even more justification for applying that measure, seeing that the very existence of the nation was at stake. Of course, this suggestion would give rise to the question, is it possible to eradicate ideas by force of arms? Could a Weltanschlung be attacked by means of physical force? At that time, I turned these questions over and over again in my mind. By studying analogous cases exemplified in history, particularly those which had arisen from religious circumstances, I came to the following fundamental conclusion. Ideas and philosophical systems, as well as movements grounded on a definite spiritual foundation, whether true or not, can never be broken by the use of force after a certain stage, except on one condition, namely, that this use of force is in the service of a new idea, or Weltanschlung, which burns with a new flame. The application of force alone, without moral support based on a spiritual concept, can never bring about the destruction of an idea, or arrest the propagation of it, unless one is ready and able ruthlessly to exterminate the last upholders of that idea, even to a man, and also wipe out any tradition which it may tend to leave behind. Now, in the majority of cases, the result of such a course has been to exclude such a state, either temporarily or forever, from the comity of states that are of political significance. But experience has also shown that such a sanguinary method of extirpation arouses the better section of the population under the persecuting power. As a matter of fact, every persecution which has no spiritual motives to support it is morally unjust and raises opposition amongst the best elements of the population. So much so that these are driven more and more to champion the ideas that are unjustly persecuted. With many individuals, this arises from the sheer spirit of opposition to every attempt at suppressing spiritual things by brute force. In this way, the number of convinced adherents of the persecuted doctrine increases as the persecution progresses. Hence, the total destruction of a new doctrine can be accomplished only by a vast plan of extermination. But this, in the final analysis, means the loss of some of the best blood in a nation or state. And that blood is then avenged, because such an internal and total clean-up brings about the collapse of the nation's strength. And such a procedure is always condemned to futility from the very start, if the attack doctrine should happen to have spread beyond a small circle. That is why, in this case, as with all other growths, the doctrine can be exterminated in its earliest stages. As time goes on, its powers of resistance increase, until at the approach of age it gives way to younger elements, but under another form, and from other motives.